The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week, we're going to be talking about science and politics and their sometimes surprising effects on each other. A little later on, we'll talk to Katie Gibbs to get an update on what's going on at Canadian science advocacy organization Evidence for Democracy. And we'll also speak to Shane Trimmer about a new U.S. political action committee dedicated to electing science, technology, engineering, and math professionals, as well as pro-science candidates, to public office. But first, let's talk about how your particular political persuasion can actually affect your ability to do simple math. You're listening to Science for the People, and this is Desiree Schell. My guest is Dan Kahan, the Elizabeth K. Dollard Professor of Law and Professor of Psychology at Yale Law School. He's a member of the Cultural Cognition Project, an interdisciplinary team of scholars who use empirical methods to examine the impact of group values on perceptions of risk and science communication. In studies funded by the National Science Foundation, Professor Kahan and his collaborators have investigated public conflict over climate change, public reactions to emerging technologies, and public understandings of scientific consensus across disputed issues. Dan, wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So maybe start off by telling us a bit about the Cultural Cognition Project.
Well, it's pretty much like you described it in your introduction, but basically we're trying to understand how it is that people who have a variety of outlooks, the kind of diverse people you find in liberal democratic societies, figure out what's known collectively and what's known by science. And actually, probably until recently, nobody even thought that this was, you know, even a complicated or interesting thing to examine. Of course, now it's like, well, this is really a problem. There's so many conflicts about decision-relevant science, and the people who disagree are people clearly who have different kinds of outlooks on life. And so we find that very interesting, but like a lot of other people, often very troubling in many respects, since it really kind of raises questions about the prospects for enlightened self-government.
Well, you've done some interesting research on something that we take for granted, that the more information we have about a topic, the more likely we are to make good decisions about it. But your research says otherwise. Can you walk us through it?
I would want to qualify it and say that people don't invariably do worse when they have more information. But if we're talking about these kinds of strange spectacles where people with different outlooks find themselves in persistent disagreement about what the basic facts are, the problem doesn't seem to be that they don't have access to enough information, or even that they really aren't able to think in a rational way about it. We've done experiments, for example, where we just furnish people with evidence, the kind that they might see in an experiment, and then ask them, well, how would you interpret the evidence? If the evidence is styled as the results of an experiment that looks at the effectiveness, say, of a new treatment for skin rash, something that's politically innocuous, then people will do either well or not so well, depending on their level of proficiency in quantitative reasoning. But if you show them the same problem, or show it another people who have the same values, the same problem, and you style it as the results of an experiment involving gun control, then it turns out that the ability of people to get the right answer is very much dependent on whether the information, if it's properly understood, supports the result that's consistent with their political ideology or not. So conservatives are much more likely to get the right answer if the evidence properly understood suggests that gun control is making crime go up. People aren't able to protect themselves. Whereas liberals would do better if, in fact, the information properly understood suggests that, well, crime went down when gun control was adopted. And that's a general effect. But probably the most startling thing about the result, or most kind of intriguing thing about it, is that effect is magnified by people's reasoning proficiency. The people who are better at quantitative reasoning, the ones who are more likely to get the answer right when it was about an innocuous topic like the skin rash treatment, they're actually even more likely to polarize when it's now about guns. They're more likely to get it right than their low numeracy counterparts if the answer is consistent with their political ideology. But they're even better at, I guess, explaining their way out of a, a kind of conundrum if the information doesn't fit their ideology. So they end up even more polarized. The people who are the highest in this kind of important facet of reasoning, they just end up even more divided about something pretty simple. How do you make sense of information in a kind of standard two-by-two contingency table that a social scientist or a normal scientist would look at?
So regardless of whether people were initially good at math, they suddenly became bad at it when you added an element of politicization.
Well, in some sense, the people who were better at it became worse. Oh. I mean, in a sense, they had more room to for their performance to degrade. It wasn't an easy problem. It's the kind of thing where a lot of times you catch yourself saying, I made a mistake here because I looked for the information available to me that was confirming a hypothesis and forgot to check the aspects of it that could disconfirm it. That's a pretty common mistake, and the problem we used was designed to see if people would catch themselves doing it. And the people who caught themselves doing it with the most kind of consistency, because they have, in fact, a high numeracy capacity, in the skin cream example, well, they would only catch themselves doing it in the gun control example when the kind of alternative to this critical reasoning would have given them an answer they didn't like. But that's why they were more polarized. They were more likely to get the right answer than their low numeracy counterparts if the information supported the answer that was ideologically congenial. Otherwise, no more. And so they end up more polarized. And this actually was a follow-up experiment to something we had done looking at how science literacy relates to conflict about climate change. And one hypothesis, and it's a perfectly good one, is that people are confused about a topic like climate change because it's complicated and it's hard for people to understand the information or involves reasoning about evidence that really most people have a hard time with. But we found that the people who are highest in science comprehension, measured in various ways, again, they were the most polarized along ideological grounds. That was a survey. It suggested that maybe people were using their science comprehension, in effect, to reinforce their beliefs. But, that was just one interpretation. That's why we did this experiment, see if we can catch people using their critical reasoning capacities in the act. And that's one of a couple experiments we've done like that. But that's what seems to be going on. Not that people don't have enough information, not that they don't have the same information, and not even necessarily that they can't make sense of information, because the people who, in an objective way, are the best at understanding empirical data, well, now they're using that capacity in a way that tends to magnify or reinforce the differences.
Now, and again, let's just clarify, this is across the political spectrum, correct?
It's an effect that's symmetric, essentially. So the people who were on the right were displaying the same kind of engagement with information as people on the left. They're considering one and the same piece of information and what effect they give to it. Do they say that the study result is valid or not? Or does it support this result or not? It depends on how you're basically experimentally framing the political significance of the information. And that seems to happen on both sides. That's an interesting question, too. Is one side more disposed to this kind of politically motivated reasoning, you might call it,
right,
than the other? Well, we've done a study on that, too, and it was experimental. And what it showed is that when people look at evidence of whether people are open-minded, they think the evidence is valid or not, depending on whether you tell them it shows that people with their ideology are the ones who are more open-minded or less. And so on both the right and left, people would treat evidence that a certain kind of test measured open-mindedness as being valid and convincing, but only if they were told first that people who disagreed with them on climate change had been shown to be closed-minded. If they were told that people who had the position that was different from theirs on climate change had scored higher, then they found the evidence in favor of the test to be very unconvincing, the independent evidence of it. So, in effect, they were displaying the same kind of tendency to fit their assessment of the quality of the evidence to their political predispositions on the question whether people do exactly that. And again, we found that the people who scored the highest in a critical reasoning test, the very one we were asking them the validity about, were the ones who did this the most. But it was symmetric on both the right and left. Nobody is particularly eager to embrace the conclusion that people who have the same outlooks they do are closed-minded.
So what's your interpretation of all this then? Why? Why?
Well, you know, my interpretation, and here's the thing, there's a real kind of risk that if we focus on these kinds of phenomena, whether it's the spectacle of the disagreement that we see in the real world all around us, or the results of studies like the ones I'm describing, which are trying to understand which of various hypotheses about why we see that are right, we can end up with a really exaggerated sense of the prevalence of this phenomenon. I mean, the phenomenon being that people are, in fact, divided politically on questions of fact that don't seem to really have anything to do with their values, or that people who are more disposed to use critical reasoning are going to, in a sense, use it opportunistically. Those cases are really very unusual. They're almost pathological, both in the sense of being very rare and in the sense of being bad. People aren't likely to figure out evidence that's essential to their well-being when this happens. But the number of issues that are like that is tiny in relation to the number of questions where science is giving them information that's important for their lives. And they're not polarized. And where people who are higher in science comprehension do better. The skin cream control was essentially an example of that. But at least in the United States, you know, we don't have disputes about even, you know, raw milk, you know, or something like this. And some people, I guess, think it's an issue, but that's not culturally polarizing here.
Right.
We don't have contestation about whether cell phones cause brain tumors. I guess some places they argue about that. Or whether you get leukemia from power lines, whether x-rays are dangerous. I mean, the number of issues where we don't see this is orders of magnitude larger. And so the question is, what's distinctive about the issues that end up with that kind of pathology? And I know you're going to ask me, well, what is it? But the point is that we really are trying to understand how it is that something that usually happens without incident, people with diverse values converge on the best available information, gets screwed up.
Because I'm wondering, now, this effect, and you call it protective identity cognition, so it doesn't hold true for all debates, but maybe, is it the ideology that makes us stupid, or is it the emotion that comes along ideology?
I would say that one hypothesis could be that people are uninformed, and a related one, that they're stupid, that even if you give them the information, they can't get things. But in fact, they can, and they do on most things. The problem is not that, you know, stupid people. It's I would say a polluted science communication environment. That what's distinctive of these issues that have that kind of strange quality, polarization about a fact that gets worse as people become more science comprehending, is that positions on these issues have become entangled in cultural symbols, meanings that make them into kind of badges of membership and loyalty to particular groups. So you just know what somebody's like and who their friends are. If they have this position on climate change and gun control, the HPV vaccine, nuclear power, and people are really have a much bigger stake in forming views that are consistent with their identity on those kinds of issues than they do in getting the answer right. What you believe about climate change, it really doesn't affect the climate. You know, you don't matter enough as a consumer or as a voter or as a person making arguments to have an impact on how people are engaging the environment or what policies we're going to have. So you make a mistake on that in any of those areas of life, and you don't increase the risk for you or anybody else you care about. Now, if you make a mistake in aligning yourself on a position that defines your membership in the group, as it were, that could really be miserable. You could end up ostracized. It drives a wedge between you and other people whose good opinion you depend on a lot. So it's actually pretty rational for people, if that's the kind of significance the issue has, to attend to the information that helps them reliably form a view that's consistent with the one in their group. And the better they are at making sense of information, the better they do. I mean, that's what we find in the experiments. But that's unusual, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the problem there is this polluted science communication environment, these meanings that become entangled in the facts. Those essentially disable the faculties that people use, people who are really good at critical reasoning, but plenty of people who are just modest at it, to figure out what's known in society. And so what we need to know is how to prevent that from happening in the first place and how to fix it once it does happen.
Well, let's go back to the science communication part. So where are we lacking in science communication if this is continually an issue, these cognitive biases?
I'd start like this. The people in the United States and Canada, too, they're not the science illiterate. People in North America, they do really well on science literacy tests, and people in the United States do just as well or better than people in Europe. They're polarized on these issues because they have this other quality to them. There was a Pew survey last summer, and it asked the question, which gas is it that scientists believe when added to the atmosphere causes the temperature to increase? Is it, you know, radon? Is it, you know, oxygen? Is it helium? Is it carbon dioxide? Well, 60% of the people who responded to the survey got it right, said carbon dioxide. There was zero correlation with their political outlooks. The Republicans were 60% likely to get it right. The Democrats are 60% likely to get it right. Now, the percentage of Democrats who believe or who say when they're asked in the poll, are humans causing climate change, it's a lot higher than 60%. It's probably 90%. And the percentage of Republicans who say that they think humans are causing climate change, a lot lower than 60%. It's probably like 25%. Right? That means that a lot of Democrats who say climate change is happening don't know this basic fact.
Interesting.
And a lot of Republicans who say climate change isn't happening know that when you add carbon to the atmosphere, the temperature increases. There's no correlation between what they know and these positions that they're taking. The question, do you believe in climate change? Is it happening? It's not measuring what they know. It's asking them who they are. They know the answer to that question. And if that's what it is, then telling them more and more, changing what they know, isn't going to cause them to converge. The only thing that will is something that communicates to them that who they are does not entail a position that's different from what they know on a question like that. What is it that we can communicate to people? What is it that they know on all of these other questions that enables them to converge? You know, they don't know more about pasteurization of milk. The biologists aren't better science communicators and climate scientists, and that's not why we don't have polarization there. What they know is that everybody who's like them, everybody they look to try to figure out, well, you know, what's going on around here? You know, who knows what? What are smart people doing? They all have that position, and it doesn't matter what group they're in. When they look up on climate change, what they see is people like me believe this and people like that believe something else. What they don't have is the kind of orienting effect that they get when their science communication environment is filled with cues, pointers, that people who know what the heck they're doing are orienting themselves in a way that affirms the validity of the science. That's what I'd give them, you know. give them that. That's how they figure out everything about what's known in science. And maybe if you gave them that, if you showed them that lots of people just like them, you know, whether it's people in the insurance industry, whether it's energy, utility companies, whether it's homeowners here, are all using this information in a certain way on climate science, that would also help to dissolve the connection that they now have in their minds between positions on this issue and identity, right, which is the thing that drives them apart.
This is super interesting to me because now I'm wondering, you know, some people don't consider themselves as much a part of a tribe as other people, right? They have less solid ideologies. So should we be trying to speak to them rather than the people that are more rooted in that?
Now, this gets into like almost an inside baseball issue.
Of course.
But I've been talking about this as right-left.
Right.
And usually in the research that my collaborators and I do, we have a different way to measure what people's values or their group commitments are. Their cultural outlooks, we call them. And it's not that complicated. Maybe it's twice as complicated because there are two dimensions, you know, kind of hierarchy and egalitarianism versus individualism and communitarianism, not just right and left. We think it helps us to explain more issues. But another advantage it has over the conventional right-left way of measuring people's commitments is that it helps to identify just how kind of pervasive and deep polarization on an issue like climate change has become. Because when I use those measures, I can find people who are really independents who lean Democrat, independents who lean Republican. But if I know what their cultural outlooks are, they turn out to be even more polarized than I would predict they'd be if all I knew was that they were strong Democrats or strong Republicans. At this point, I mean, and again, this is unusual. It's pathological. The depth of the association between the position and the identities is so far down. You don't have to be somebody who's a news junkie. We have the MSNBC and Fox News, and at the same time that one group is watching Rachel Maddow and another group is watching Bill O'Reilly, literally orders of magnitude more are watching America's Funniest Pet Videos.
Right.
Those people are as divided as the ones who are watching those shows.
Really?
Because they might not be partisan, but they're social people. And they're people who figure out what's known by consulting people who have their outlooks on life. So at this point, you know, this is no longer just a game for the kind of politically interested class.
Right.
You know, maybe genetically modified food or something is like that. But if you talk to people who are in the middle, if you're really on the middle on something like this, you're probably just confused. I mean, this is a state of polarization that's really profound. I mean, you know, other people might disagree with me, but I actually think that the idea of talking to people in the middle doesn't make a lot of sense. The people in the middle are kind of noise in your statistical analysis, but because you can't explain why they have the views they do, you can't identify what it is that moves them one way or the other. The way you figure that out is by knowing what kind of people are and who they listen to and what resonates with them. Change the resonance for people who aren't kind of in this confused, you know, tiny middle would be my prescription.
That sounds really difficult.
I think it is difficult, but, you know, it's not impossible. I mean, and I think you have to be kind of opportunistic, pragmatic about it, too. I'm not going to tell you, well, here's the, you know, the strategy and it works in all contexts or something like this. But on something like climate change, at the same time in the United States, we have this tremendous division on climate change as a national issue. We have these local communities all over the country that are using climate science to try to figure out what to do to protect themselves from climate impacts. So from Arizona, where they have the Tea Party governor, to Florida, the same thing. Florida has a Tea Party governor and a Tea Party legislature, to Virginia, you know, to the North Carolina, South Carolina, and of course up into, you know, states, the blue states like Connecticut where I live. You've got all of these local movements with local governments trying to figure out what to do about adaptation. And even in the states where you can't say climate change as a politician without being instantly electrocuted, they're talking a lot about what to do and using that same science. We at the research group I work for, I work with, we're going to give evidence-based support services for science communication to a group of counties in Florida, the Southeast Florida Climate Compact. And these counties are very politically divided, somewhat conservative, but they adopt plans, you know, climate plan just a couple weeks ago in Palm Beach County. You know, 7-0 in their county commission, 4 Democrats, 3 Republicans, has 100 different programs in it relating to adaptation and mitigation. But for them, this is an issue about how do you live in Florida. When they talk about that issue, they all have the same stake, right? They all have the identity as Floridians who want to figure out how to keep doing what they've been doing all this time. And there's no need to say, hey, be consistent or whatever. What are you talking about is an issue of meaning as well. So find a way and a place to engage the science that doesn't come with that kind of entanglement between the positions and the identity. That's one thing you can do, and that opportunity is out there in the United States.
Could you leave us with some suggestions on as to how we can deal with our own ideologically related biases? How can we ensure that we're not automatically discarding facts that don't agree with our worldview?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think the first thing is to recognize that you can't be confident. You can't be sure that, in fact, if you were sure, that would be the strongest evidence that really you weren't being reflective about it. There's no reason to assume that beliefs you have are the product of bias. And in fact, there's no less reason to believe, you know, your views on any of these disputed issues than others. You have the same sources of information. But there's a reason to be unhappy about the kind of atmosphere in which you're forming the view. Nobody can be as comfortable with the process by which they're forming beliefs under these circumstances as they otherwise would be. And that's a position I think that people on the right and left share. I find, for example, that, you know, our research tends to be, well, I mean, some people agree, some people disagree, but it's not ideologically polarizing. sometimes people say, oh, yeah, I recognize that. That's why the other side's biased. But they actually also say, you know, sometimes this happens to me. What do we do about this? And I think the recognition of people, if you step away from any particular issue and just say, you know, this is a problem we all have, that actually helps. That you'll find when you do that, who else, regardless of their political orientation, wants to contribute to a project where we can rid the kind of science communication environment of those toxic elements that disable reasoning on both sides. That's not going to mean we're going to agree on what to do. I mean, what to do is a question of value. But nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows what policies are going to fit their values if they can't tell what the facts are. And I think people are, of all ideologies, all cultural outlooks, actually, you know, recognize this phenomenon that I'm talking about. And when they're not talking about a particular issue, like gun control, you know, they're going to shoot each other if they're talking only about that. But instead, this general question of how can we create conditions in which we don't observe this kind of pathology, they do find ways to agree. And they might find things that they can do, at least to try to prevent these things from happening again and again and again, you know, even as they still have to deal with, you know, the very consequential and difficult problems we have from our failure to protect ourselves from it in the past.
Dan, you are lovely. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been really an interesting and fun discussion.
And that was Dan Kahan, professor of law and professor of psychology at Yale Law School, discussing the Cultural Cognition Project. And we've linked to Dan and the project on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. My guest is Shane Trimmer, the executive director of Franklin's List, a political action committee dedicated to electing scientists and pro-science candidates in the U.S. Previous to Franklin's List, he served as a staff member for elected officials at the state level in Sacramento, California, as well as the federal level in Washington, D.C., and worked for nonprofits in health, environmental, and transportation policy. Great to have you here, Shane.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So let's start out with a bit of background. What is Franklin's List?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, Franklin's List is a political action committee here in the United States. And our main mission and goal and vision is to raise the scientific literacy and understanding in Congress and state houses across this country to ensure that science informs decisions being made instead of the other way around. We look to accomplish these goals first by supporting political candidates who have a background in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, and secondly, to support pro-science candidates who may not have that formal background in a STEM education, but are looking to oppose a quote-unquote anti-science candidate. So to give you a little bit of the background of where we started, the idea of Franklin's List came about from current congressman out of Illinois, Bill Foster, who was a physicist working at Fermilab over there. And he was, in 2011, came up with this idea after his previous stint in Congress, where he saw that the need for more scientifically informed political professionals was a great need, particularly at the national level. And so he worked toward this effort until some favorable redistricting happened, and he saw a chance for him to gain back a seat in Congress, at which point I took over the effort. And so we are looking to be able to start making endorsements for candidates here very shortly, and hopefully we'll be able to make a dent and hopefully a positive work toward positively affecting this current election cycle, but then really being able to hit the ground running during the 2016 election cycle, which will be a presidential election cycle here in this country.
So now, what was the reasoning behind it? Is
Is there a problem with politicians not understanding science? I can't even say that with a straight face.
That's right. That's right. You know, absolutely. The need is definitely there. And a big concern that I've heard amongst talking with a lot of these related nonprofits is that, you know, trying to get scientists more involved civically and at the national level has been a little bit tough. They tried to make science as apolitical as possible. And so they tried to not get involved, but it's now getting to the point where they're seeing how the decisions being made here and the things that a lot of the politicians are saying are just in the face of what they know to be true and what their work entails. And, you know, with consistent budget cuts, with the sequester and last year's government shutdown, they're starting to see exactly how the decisions being made here and at the state level are directly affecting their work in the lab. And so what you're going to see is more and more scientists get involved civically, maybe not running for elected office themselves, but whether or not they wanted science to remain apolitical, politicians have made it a political issue. And so they're going to need to start getting involved to make sure that, as I said at the beginning, that science informs the political decisions rather than the other way around.
But this is a nonpartisan effort, correct?
Correct, absolutely. You know, and it's important for us to remain nonpartisan because it's silly for us to think about science as a partisan issue. You know, it's important for me to relay the difference between a bipartisan organization and a nonpartisan organization. So us as a nonpartisan organization, we don't really think about what either party are saying. We don't really care what the Republicans are saying. We don't care what the Democrats are saying. What we care about is it a pro-science message? And that's our bias. Whereas a bipartisan organization, they look to see what one side's saying, what the other side's saying, and try to meet them in the middle. Whereas, you know, the scientific consensus doesn't meet in the middle between what the scientists are saying and what the politicians are saying.
Okay, now before we get to sort of the tangible goals of what you're trying to do, maybe for our non-American listeners, can you explain what a PAC is?
Absolutely. So it's a political action committee, which is a purely election-based organization dedicated to helping either elect certain candidates or replace certain candidates. And you know, it becomes very, when you start getting into the American election system and the money that comes into play, it becomes a very, it's hard to explain very briefly.
I would suggest that everybody who really wants a very thorough definition watch the Colbert Report. Just Google that and Google Colbert Report and PAC.
Absolutely.
And that was
absolutely
the only time I've ever even close to understood what you people are talking.
And that's exactly the reference that I give to a lot of people, too. When he started his Colbert Super PAC, it showed a lot of the differences in kind of the post-Citizens United political world. And we are a traditional political action committee, so we are able to directly coordinate and support these candidates, which is important because, you know, a lot of these scientists, they might not have thought about politics as a career option when they were, you know, working in the lab and trying to do their research, working on their doctorate. Most of the time it comes out as where they see that the need is there after they've been working in the field for a long time. And this isn't the case for a lot of lawyers and businessmen who might have always considered politics as a secondary option. And so being able to have a list of volunteers that we can give to them at the moment that they decided that they would like to enter a race and being able to directly coordinate with them on how they can move forward and try to win an election and provide a little bit of early money for them to make that jump into politics would be a very important process for us.
Now, what kind of candidates then are you trying to recruit versus who you're trying to endorse?
as I said earlier, our main goal is to try to get scientists more engaged in the political process. This will help Congress itself by getting people with more diverse backgrounds, maybe a little bit more analytical way of thinking. But currently what you have is you have a lot of non-scientists making decisions that are very important to science in this country. And you don't have to Google too much where you find a statement by somebody who might even be on a science committee in the Senate or House that's just extremely anti-scientific. Currently, every Republican on the Senate Science Committee doesn't accept that climate change is human-caused. And so these are very worrying things when you think that the scientific consensus has already been in on that, yet we're still arguing about this on a political level. And so it's important for us to get more scientists involved because they have that authority and are able to bring that perspective to the office. Whereas our secondary goal is to be able to just support pro-science candidates themselves because, you know, we're not going to be able to have, you know, 100 scientists in 100 different districts trying to run. And there's a lot of very good politicians out there that have a very good understanding of what it means to have science inform their policy. And if they have a question, won't just kind of guess on the fly, but will, you know, see what maybe ask scientists on their advisory committee what their next approach should be to it.
What if a candidate is good on one science-related issue, but not so much on the other? For example, what if they are great on climate change, but they unfortunately believe that vaccines cause autism? Would you still endorse them?
Yeah, so in that situation, which is why we have a litmus test to be able to weed out some of these candidates, it's important that the scientific consensus informs policy. And in the case of vaccines, the consensus has long been in on that. You know, and I'll give you the example of Governor Bobby Jindal out of Louisiana. He's not a scientist, but his undergraduate degree was in biology, yet he signed in the Louisiana Science Education Act, which is an issue that the National Center for Science Education has been fighting very hard, because what it did is it opened up the teaching for Louisiana teachers to be able to teach creationism or quote-unquote intelligent design in school textbooks and in the classroom there. And so, you know, just because you have a little bit of a background in science doesn't mean that you're great on all issues or even on science topics themselves. And so it will be important that we get scientists in there who do support the scientific consensus on issues that have long since been understood.
What about, do you by any chance have a strategy for dealing with people who are already elected that are weak on science? Like, will you actively work against their election?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That would be very important for us to reach our mission and goal of trying to raise a scientific literacy and understanding of science in Congress and state houses across the country. It'll be, you know, there's already candidates and politicians out there who've shown that they do not have an understanding of the scientific issues when it comes to climate change or evolution, especially at the state level. And so it'll be important for us to be able to have candidates who will be able to challenge them and replace them. That's why it's important for us to stay nonpartisan, is because for a lot of these districts where the constituency is very conservative, a Republican will always win these districts. And so it'll allow us to be able to try to identify a moderate Republican who might be able to stand up and, as John Huntsman did in the last presidential election cycle, say, you know what, I support the scientific consensus on evolution, on climate change.
Now, you've worked as a political staffer in the past, and you've also worked with nonprofits. So how difficult is it to lobby for science issues?
It's growing harder in the country today because, as I'm sure you can see even from Canada, the growing partisan divide in the country is a very real thing. And people are starting to echo chambers are starting to form, and it's growing harder to have a collaborative discussion. And advocating pro-science issues shouldn't be a partisan issue, but when it comes to putting more money into scientific research, that has now become a partisan issue when we kind of have these cut-first budgets. And yet science is, it's so easy to advocate for, because, you know, everybody wants to have a moon base. However, what they don't realize is that it's going to take some money and some initial investment up front. So it's going to take a lot of this basic research to be able to find ways to get there. I know that there was a study that NASA did where they had a group of volunteers lay in a bed for 6 months or so to find out how your muscles react to laying in bed for, you know, and to being, to not working out and to being in kind of a zero gravity environment. And these are the kind of basic research, this is the kind of basic research that needs to be done to be able to lead to these overarching goals.
Right. I'm just wondering, when you're lobbying, not that you do it now, but when you did it previously, do you focus on the science, or do you play up the other angles, like long-term sustainability or cost or such?
Absolutely. And science is such an easy thing to advocate for, because the return on investment in basic scientific research is astounding. I know that studies have shown that for every dollar that NASA gets, you get $6 back in economic growth from the technology that spins off from that. And what you're seeing today is that since we have consistent budget cuts and since the Cold War era, science and technology have played less of a priority in the country. And what you're going to see is that not today, not tomorrow, but in 20 to 30 years, you're going to see that where that lack of priority in science is going to hurt us. And so when I'm advocating for science or trying to promote more money for scientific research, there's a part of me that really wants to just say, well, you know, we should put more money to this because this is how we find out how the world works, you know, and this is very cool, you know, but that's not gonna get the funding. but it's very easy to make the other argument where there is no greater return on investment than the money you put toward basic scientific research. However, because a lot of those spin-offs might not come for 25, 30 years.
And so that's difficult for people to really internalize.
Absolutely. There's no 30-year election cycle. Neil deGrasse Tyson was here in D.C. last year and speaking to some of the congressional staffers, and he promoted this idea, which I thought was fantastic, and that's that everybody who puts forward a bill in an election cycle also has to put forward at least one bill that would affect people 50 years down the road.
Interesting. Now whether,
you know, and it would never happen, but it's just a great way to think about how important thinking about future generations could be and how that would help a lot of the scientific research and trying to promote funding for basic science.
So how can people support Franklin's List or get involved, either as a donor or as a potential candidate?
Absolutely. And there's many ways, and I have to apologize in advance to many of our Canadian friends who I know listen to this show, where because we are an election organization based here in the United States, we cannot accept donations from non-U.S. citizens. But you guys can help us by contacting and trying to support us by trying to get your American friends to go to our website and to follow what I will be telling a lot of the Americans for what they can do. First, you know, the sad reality in United States politics is that nothing can get done without financial backing. And we are very much a grassroots organization, and every little bit will help us toward our mission and goals. But there's a lot of things that you can do if you don't have money to contribute. Volunteers are huge and much appreciated by a lot of these political campaigns. And you can go to our website and offer to volunteer for us or for political candidates who might emerge later on in your area. You can also go to our website and sign up for updates, and we'll let you know when a political candidate who has a science background or is pro-science who is running in your area, so you can directly support them through donations or through volunteering.
I love it. I love this process. I would also like to point out to Canadians that we don't have anything like this. So if anyone has some free time out there, might be something to think about.
A lot of free time, but it's well worth it in the end.
Right. Shane, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
And that was Shane Trimmer, the executive director of Franklin's List, a U.S. political action committee dedicated to electing scientists and pro-science candidates. We've linked to it on our site at scienceforthepeople.ca.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're learning about botany and the colorful science of gardening. Author Ruth Kassinger joins us to discuss her book, A Garden of Marvels, how we discovered that flowers have sex, leaves eat air, and other secrets of the way plants work. And we'll speak to NASA researcher Joya Massa about her work to solve the technical challenges of gardening in space. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
This is Science for the People, and I'm joined by Katie Gibbs, the Executive Director of Evidence for Democracy. Welcome back, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to get a quick update on what Evidence for Democracy is up to lately. But let's start with some background for anyone who hasn't heard of your organization. What's its history?
Well, we actually got started, we sort of formed out of the Death of Evidence rally that happened in the summer of 2012. It was pretty much the biggest science rally that I think we've seen in Canadian history. And it just sort of started this sort of momentum of scientists wanting to get more engaged and more sort of outspoken in talking about science integrity issues in Canada and evidence-based policy development and issues like that.
So what other kinds of campaigns might people have heard of from Evidence for Democracy?
Yeah, well, we followed up the Death of Evidence rally with Stand Up for Science rallies all across the country in September of last year. We also did a big campaign focused on how government scientists were being silenced and suppressed, called Science Uncensored, trying to raise some awareness for that. And then we've also been doing some work around the closure of federal science libraries as well.
And how'd that go?
Well, I mean, in both cases, you know, really what we're trying to focus on is educating the public and trying to, you know, get them to sign petitions about these issues, to also show the government that, you know, it is an issue that people care about. And I think when they make these kind of changes, you know, they expect that, oh, scientists, they may not like it, but they're not going to be very vocal.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is sort of, you know, organize and strengthen and mobilize a response to that, to show that we are going to be sort of, you know, a vocal, outspoken group about this.
And you also submitted feedback on the federal science strategy?
Yeah, so the government essentially did a consultation period in February with fairly short notice, a very, very short time period of soliciting feedback. They also, they did some sort of like actual roundtable consultations with invited people who were able to contribute. I'm fairly connected into the science policy world, and I don't, you know, not only were we not invited, which, you know, that I could possibly understand, but I don't know anybody who was invited to these roundtable consultation events. So I'm not entirely sure who the guest list was or how they determined who that would be. But essentially they put out a bit of a white paper talking about their strategy and solicited feedback. So we drafted our response, and really the paper that they wrote about the strategy, it only talked about business and technology related research. It didn't talk at all about all of the other kinds of government science that is done, that is crucially important, like medical research, environmental monitoring. It almost completely ignored like basic research and curiosity-driven research. So it was a little shocking to us that they would do, you know, essentially the foundation of the science strategy and just not even include these really important aspects of Canadian science. So we did a draft response, and then we tried to encourage other scientists around the country to sort of send in, you know, either backing our proposal or making their own comments. And because of the tight timeline that they had it available for, we only had a week to do this campaign. And even in just that 1 week, we had 1,300 scientists across the country submit feedback to their strategy. So we thought that was a pretty good success.
Now, what's going to be done with this feedback? It's going to be part of a larger report later on, or?
I mean, it's hard to know whether or not they'll actually use the feedback. Essentially, they're planning to come out with a revised strategy later this year. So this was sort of just a white paper soliciting feedback on the strategy, and then the formal strategy should be out later this year.
Now, Evidence for Democracy recently received the Ontario Trillium Foundation grant to promote evidence-based policies. What is that?
Trillium is sort of a bit of an arm's-length Ontario foundation. So it's actually where sort of lottery winnings go. They go into this pool called the Trillium Foundation, and then they, you know, give it to organizations and causes that they think are doing good work. So for us, it was really our first big grant that we've received. So, you know, it was hugely monumental for us. It basically provides some base operation funding for the next 2 years. So that's really, really great and really provides a bit more stability for the work that we're doing. And I think it's also really telling that an organization is as big as Trillium is funding this work. It really shows that there is some momentum around these issues and that organizations and funders are starting to realize that this is an important issue that we should be funding and supporting.
So let's be clear. Before the grant, you were pretty much doing what you were doing, which is everything, with no funding.
We've always had, you know, funding from our supporters and just donations from individuals, which is still an important part of our funding. But yes, at that point, I was working mostly as a volunteer. And then with the Trillium grant, we've been able to actually hire me full time, which is great.
So then what is new in science and Canadian politics? What should Canadians know that we might not?
Well, I think one of the biggest stories this year that's really, you know, started in January and has continued to get a lot of media attention has been the closure of so many federal science libraries. So it really started with DFO libraries. Somebody released essentially a leaked photo of a dumpster full of books and materials. And, you know, this really, it's a pretty striking photo to see all this important research and documents just in the trash. So stories sort of keep coming out about that. It really started with DFO, Fisheries and Oceans Canada libraries. We've also seen closures to Health Canada libraries, Natural Resources libraries, as well as a whole bunch of other government libraries as well. Even just a few weeks ago, a new article surfaced. They did an access to information request and found that people at Health Canada, you know, really did express concern that the closure of their library would really limit their ability to make evidence-based decisions. And yet their library was still closed. So this is obviously pretty alarming and quite shocking. Another thing that we might not have talked about before, but actually in November of last year, the official opposition put forward a private members bill calling for a parliamentary science officer. So this is also something that we had actually been pushing for as well. And basically the idea is to create an office that's sort of similar to the parliamentary budget officer, but focusing on science. So it would report directly to parliament. It could sort of be a bit of a science watchdog in government and in parliament. And it could also help sort of coordinate the science and research that goes on in different department silos and help ensure that there's some continuity there. So it's still sort of up in the air. We're still waiting for the next vote on that. But that's also a really interesting idea that we're happy to see is gaining some attention and momentum. And then, of course, there was a new federal budget out in February. So this, it did have some new funding for research. There was a sort of Canada First Research Excellence Fund. The money doesn't kick in until 2015. So people, the research community seems to have been a little, I think, having a sort of a wait and see approach to this. Mm. Definitely some people, you know, saw this as a big success, that there was some money coming back there, but the money, you know, it hasn't kicked in yet. We're sort of going to wait and see, you know, what that actually looks like and what it transpires to. But, you know, obviously more money to science is a good thing, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't touch all of those other problems that we're seeing with government science. So this would be funding for academic research.
Tentative optimism then.
Yes.
Where we are. All right. So what does Evidence for Democracy have planned to attempt to impact change on sort of any of those fronts?
As we grow a little bit and are expanding our capacity, we're working on some larger projects that are larger than anything we've done before. So instead of quick reactionary campaigns, we're really working on some big things to release in the fall. So one of the things that we're doing is we've had a research assistant who's been looking at the communication policies for government scientists, and she's sort of assessing them, and we're going to do sort of a report card on government transparency that's really looking at the communication policies for government scientists. And what we're doing is we're using a similar metric that a group in the U.S. has used called the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they've done this a number of times in the U.S. So what's great about this is, you know, we'll get a report card for looking at how good our policies are, but it will also allow us to compare to the U.S. and see how our communication policies compare to the U.S. So I'm really excited for that, and that's going to be out in the early fall. The other really big project that we're working on right now is it's called sort of Governing in the Dark, and it's going to be sort of an interactive website that we hope is going to really document all the ways in which there's been changes to the way evidence is collected, used, and communicated. You know, there's been so many examples, so many stories, but you can't really just, there's no one place that you can go online right to really find all these examples and to have them put into context for you and tell these stories. So we're working on a really big site that is going to do that. And that's also going to be out sort of mid to late fall next year.
That's fantastic. So is that going to focus on sort of the federal election then? Will it be out in time for that?
Yes, exactly. So it's going to be out in the fall, and most of the examples are going to be at the federal level.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and of course, if the work of Evidence for Democracy is resonating with any of our listeners, there are ways for them to get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the work that we do actually is done by volunteers. We have tons of excellent volunteers, and we can always use more of them. So, you know, if you're interested in getting involved, this Governing in the Dark site that I talk about, we have volunteers working on collecting that data. So, you know, there's so many different ways that people can volunteer. So if you're at all interested, let me know. And then, of course, you know, check out our website. There's different campaigns and petitions that you can sign on to. We have a petition still going for the science library closures. We're also putting together a network of experts. So this is something that's really cool, and essentially, you know, trying to sort of organize the scientific and research community so that then, you know, for example, when there's scientist letters that go around, we can send them out to our network of experts to sort of increase sign on to those kind of things, as well as, you know, they help inform our campaigns. They help alert us to issues going on in their fields that might be alarming. They're sort of our eyes and ears out there. So I encourage people to check that out as well.
And where can people find you?
You can find all this information on our website, evidencefordemocracy.ca.
Katie, I love your work. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having us on again.
And you can find a link to Katie Gibbs and Evidence for Democracy on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're there, do click the links to connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, and to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta.
The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.